Welcome to the Canadian Tech Podcast for August 19th, 2013. My name is Stuart Clark.
I'm Jameson Roberts.
I'm Adam Forrestal.
Well, gentlemen, another Monday's here.
Yep.
In the summer, where sometimes tech news is either a desert or a flood.
I think it's a flood, especially with the way things have been going this summer.
Well, exactly. And I think, but it seems to vary. During the week, it slows down a bit. And then all of a sudden, a lot of stuff seems to happen on Monday.
Which is a bit annoying for doing this show on a Monday.
Well, exactly. It means we're scrambling through the Google Doc, updating stuff. But, you know, that's because we are trained professionals.
Exactly.
Exactly. All right. So let's get right on it. Another bit of concerning news from our good friends at BlackBerry. They've actually decided to cut production a further 10% off their Q10 model. And that's right off cutting production by 50% just last month. Between this and the fact that, you know, the company recently announced it's looking at some different strategic alternatives, including being up for sale, some analysts are think this might be directly related to that announcement last week. I'm wondering what your takes on it.
Notice they didn't say they were cutting production on the Z10, though, only the
You're both wrong.
No?
Yeah. They're cutting production on BlackBerry 10 devices.
Oh.
So that would be, to
both.
To me, that's all devices running BB10. So that's the Q10, the Z10, the Q5, the new
Z30.
It sounds like it's all of them.
Yeah. So that's bad news. I mean, at this point, is anything really good news for BlackBerry other than our sales are skyrocketing?
I'm not sure.
Or they've been bought out? I mean...
Well, the article specifically mentions poor sales of the Q5. Mm-hmm. And I'm at a point where I don't feel any sympathy for BlackBerry on this one because the Q5 kind of just showed up with a whimper. When they were announcing new devices at the beginning of the year, they said, look at our new touchscreen device, Z10. It's going to be great. And if you want to hold out for a keyboard, it's going to be great. And we're going to have these great new phones.
Yep.
And they announced those two with huge fanfare. This is what's happening. This is what's coming. And people knew to look for them. And then the Q5 just kind of slipped in. I haven't seen a single ad for it. I haven't seen any information from BlackBerry.
Well, and that's what the article's saying. Yeah, it hasn't been that much received. Also, the Q10, they've actually lowered that. Bell Canada recently reduced its price to $149 from $199 under a two-year contract.
Yep.
So now, you know, we should make a point. This discounting, it is in line with similar devices.
Yes, and it's in line with the time scale. 6 months of devices up for 6 months, seeing it drop $50 or $100 on a three-year contract. Oh, excuse me, two-year contract isn't out of the question.
Now, the interesting thing would be, I bet you they could pick up a lot of slack if they offered, say, the Q5 on zero for a two-year contract. If Bell or Rogers or Telus were willing to do something like that, they might see a lot of pickup just from the standpoint of it being in that category of a free phone.
Maybe, but I think as well, and the article also touches on it, is I think Enterprise is kind of playing a wait-and-see attitude.
Yeah.
I think originally, yeah, you know, they said there might have been a lot of pent-up demand, but I think people are seeing where the company is, and companies are deciding, well, we've already gotten many cases of bring your own device. We have,
yep.
We allow Android and Apple devices now.
Well,
and we really want to make this large investment for our official corporate fleet until we know what's going on with the company.
Well, and BlackBerry has almost shot themselves in the foot completely on software. Every time BlackBerry comes up, I always mention how good they are at software and how they were a software company first, and the hardware kind of just came along later. But the thing is, when your big things are your software, you need to keep that private and to yourself. If BlackBerry is willing to provide a back end for bring your own devices and then subsequently give those devices
exactly.
BBM, which is kind of the core major app mm-hmm. here, there's not a whole lot of incentive for companies to switch back to BlackBerry unless they have a ton of employees dying for physical keyboards, and I don't think that's the case anymore.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate, though, with you here, because if you take a look at what else is out there, you've got Microsoft or BlackBerry essentially for your major companies managing their devices. So if it's a Microsoft shop, chances are they probably have a Bez server, like a Bez setup anyways with BlackBerry. So if you can make it that much easier to bring other devices into that area that's already integrated, then it's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. There's just not...
There's no reason to...
I don't think it's enough.
Fair enough.
I don't think it's enough.
In terms of the enterprise space, I know like a lot of companies, you know, had an in-house BlackBerry server.
Yes.
You know, and that made talking to the Exchange box much easier. But, you know, the more recent versions of Exchange have a lot more on the security side,
yep.
encrypted and stuff like that. So, again, another thing is in the data center that might be saying, do we need another box?
Yeah.
You know,
and if they don't need another box, they can cut down on overhead maintenance,
well,
et cetera.
You know, and they're leveraging you know, secure email with different ways. And, you know, I also bring it out to you that maybe some companies are going, well, since our email can be read anyway.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? I don't think it's like that bad. But, you know, I think companies are definitely looking now. We've said this many times before. There's a lot of places now that are allowing, you know, non-BlackBerry devices in. And they do it with either secure email or some sort of VPN tunneling. And it keeps IT happy.
Well,
it keeps the user happy.
And I know in the United States, it doesn't take very long for the like the DoD to qualify Apple devices now to be considered a secure device to be allowed on their networks and things like that. So it's not like it's out of the realm of these devices being allowed.
That's because Apple and the NSA, you know, they're on each other's Christmas card list now, right?
Right.
With Microsoft, Google. Was BlackBerry on that list, by the way?
I don't.
They're not American, so probably not.
I doubt it.
Maybe.
Probably
there
not.
We go. Put your tinfoil hats on, people. That could be it. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, but if that was the case, wouldn't BlackBerry be doing famously well right now?
Not if they said no.
Anyways, let's move on.
You still have to. You aren't going to park consumers in their cell phones. You still have to convince people to switch over to BlackBerry.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, latest Apple rumors. September 10th is going to be an iPhone event. But we're also
Apple event of some kind.
Yeah, well, people.
Yeah, let's
said
qualify
an
that. It's
yeah.
not necessarily iPhone.
All right,
we're
especially
iPhone.
Well, especially considering they've already shown the Mac Pro.
It's not about the Mac Pro though. It's a good excuse for them to release iOS 7.
Yeah,
so, iOS 7. But we could also be seeing a thinner iPad 5. Finally, maybe a Retina level iPad Mini,
which would be nice.
Which would be nice. There
that would
to be
that would bring it in line a little more with the new Nexus 7.
Right.
Yep.
Now, this article we got from 9to5 Mac, and they got it from Bloomberg.
And there's also Mac Rumors has also been covering a bunch of this
stuff
as well.
Basically, there is multiple reports now. Thinner full-size iPad planned. Anything you can do to take the weight off the iPad, especially when you compare it to the Mini, is a good thing. The Mini, definitely. People really want that high-resolution screen. I guess people really notice the difference. If they've got a Retina iPad and then they have a Mini, they really notice the difference, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I see them both side by side on a fairly frequent basis. I'm not sure that I notice a ton of difference.
I know. That's what I would wonder.
If you go back to an iPad 2 next to a Retina, I think it's there for sure. But when you... the pixel density gets condensed into the 8-inch screen instead of the 10. It's not, if we run the math, I'm sure it's not too far off the
right.
No, it's four times this resolution. Yeah, no, it can't be super far back. I don't know. I think bringing Retina to the Mini is a good plan. I think they should, but I don't think
it's going to be that much of a difference.
If someone's trying to tell you that the current Retina display and the Mini are totally different from each other, that's it's a little far-fetched for me.
Well, exactly. I'd like to see...
It'll bring it in line, though, for developing stuff for, icon textures, for some cosmetic stuff.
Yeah, I think really what I need to see is a non-Retina and a Retina right beside each other on the same device. I haven't had a chance to do that with, like the old iPad and the new
two
iPad.
Next to each other.
I'd
no,
like
it's
to.
it's pretty stark. Go to your local blue and yellow big box store,
or I can go to my Apple store.
I guess you can. Do they have an iPad 2 sitting next to a Retina display iPad on an Apple?
Well, see,
store?
That's what it depends. That's where I really haven't had a chance
those,
to do.
Those
do
boys
that.
In
okay.
blue, they
do?
Certainly have.
Okay,
it.
All right.
Else are they rumoring for this?
Well, they're also saying there is multiple reports now. It is going to be an iPhone focused event. On the 10th.
It will probably be an iOS. If you think about how much, though, the iOS does span all of their devices, you're going to see an iPhone. They're at least going to mention a refresh of the iPads.
I'm not
going
to count on that. We talked last week about cell phones that we said were good enough that now people don't necessarily need the most cutting-edge phone. They can get something that's pretty good without going all the way up the budget. Tablets are at that point, too. I mean, the iPad 4 is good enough at this point and there's no real reason, save maybe Tegra 4 taking over the marketplace, that Apple really should feel inclined to desperately throw out that new model iPad. There's no big feature or spec they're trying to keep up with at this point. The iPad is so beyond being the market leader for tablets that we've reached a point where it's good enough. If it's going to be an iPhone-focused event, I will be curious to see how much iPad
we're going to
hear about.
Yeah, I think we're going to see mostly about the iPhone 5C or whatever they're going to call it.
Yep.
Things like that.
I think if we see a new iPad, they'll focus more on the Mini than on the full size.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be too surprised if we see the iPad 5 come out in a similar style to the 4 last year. Wasn't a whole lot of fanfare for the 4. It was,
it's coming out.
Here's a new iPad and of course with a lightning port.
And just in time for the Christmas season.
Yeah, exactly.
So, exactly.
Now, what about, what are your thoughts on anything related to the laptop line updates? Because we saw Airs.
We haven't heard a thing. I want new Pros. I want to see new Pros.
Pros.
Now, we have seen Mac Pros. Some ads have started appearing in movie trailers.
Mac Pros.
The Mac,
not MBPs.
No, we haven't seen anything for that yet.
Or MBPRs, which
We're going to wait and see what happens there, but... we're just going to have to see what they do. They decide when they release it, leaks and all. So
it'll be a fun week regardless.
It'll be an interesting September. Yeah.
Okay, here's one that was actually fairly breaking from The Guardian just today, actually. Apparently, they found a little bit of a security hole, how iOS malware can sneak through Apple's approval process.
I haven't read this particular article. Is this the one about how apparently Apple testers only test apps for 3 to 6 seconds or something, and anything that happens after that is good to go? Or is this a different one?
Basically, because I was kind of reading it at the same time. It's basically Jekyll apps. They're created with remotely exploitable vulnerabilities built in masked by legitimate features to evade detection during the App Store approval process.
That's,
When apparently what happens is, in one case they said, they only become active once it runs and has its program logic reconfigured remotely.
So it's a remote trigger then. The app works just fine until someone presses the switch on the other side. And
it sounds like a lot of different games and stuff like that. They can download content outside of the app store.
And it almost makes sense that
Yeah, well, the proof of concept was based on an open source news app called NewsYC, modified with vulnerabilities and malicious code gadgets and configured to connect to a server controlled by the research team. It was approved by Apple, released on the App Store on the 13th, for long enough for the team to download it through their own device. They then quickly removed it from the store to ensure no one else downloaded it. We have the data to show that only our testing devices installed the app.
So these were black hats
they've made a full disclosure. They were showing how it works. Then they disclosed to Apple.
All right, that's white hats then. No, that's different for sure. That's really interesting that they would go through the trouble.
Yep. So apparently Apple said they have closed this thing. But again, it's an interesting story. And it just shows how it's always, one-upmanship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about how little time they have at the last paragraph. And I quote, Apple will have to balance security concerns with the task of approving more than 4,000 new iOS apps a week based on the App Store's growth. From 65,000 apps in June 2012 to
6,500,000.
65,000. No, see, yeah, right. 650,000. Thank you. In June last year to 900,000 in June this year.
That just happened?
Yes.
That was just posted on the Guardian blog.
All right.
Guardian's always a good source for this stuff.
They're going to have to hire some more app testers,
I think.
If they're only witnessing an app for 6 to 8 seconds, I mean, that could be a problem. But
definitely. Well, and I think it's a concern. It's like I say, it's always a game of one-upmanship. They figure out something, it gets blocked, and someone else figures another thing. And as you say, when you have apps that post-install can go to a third-party server,
and
do things, how do you do that?
Well, and even something as simple as like the BBC news app, or in this case, this one, you're pulling down content. Who's to say that someone doesn't put malicious code into that content
it's executable? Certainly an option.
So you
have to keep you have to keep up on it. Exactly.
I'm going
to
sound different on every news story this time around.
I'm
just switching. I can't get comfortable tonight. I'm switching positions every
You're switching
3 minutes.
Positions? Okay. All right. Maybe we'll have them switch mics later, too, just for fun. Okay. What's our next one? Google blocks
I can't believe this happened. We were talking last... I think it was just last week. We were talking about how Microsoft really needed to get their act together on a few more of these standardized apps for Windows 8 and Windows 8 Phone.
Yep.
Stuff like Facebook and YouTube and everything else needs to appear. And I can't believe at this point that Google is now saying Microsoft cannot have a Facebook, a YouTube app, excuse me.
Yeah, but this has been going on for a while now, this game of one-upmanship between Google and Microsoft, because there was Google blocked through the browser, or there was basically this war going on back and forth between Google and Microsoft about what was going to be allowed through the browser, through the API, and so Microsoft said, fine, we'll put up an app, and now Google's saying, nope, not allowed.
Yeah,
but is this, as they're saying, is it breaking YouTube's terms of use? Is it a problem with they're not conforming to the standards?
Well, that's what Google is saying. Yeah. Without a whole bunch of back-end code, I'm not sure I'm qualified to tell you. But that's what it looks like. That's what Google's saying anyway. And I don't understand if it's using the basic HTML5 to collaborate on an app based on HTML5. Yeah,
well, apparently Google says they understand, the Verge understands that Google simply revoked the API key Microsoft was attempting to use as the software giant had reverse-engineered YouTube's ad code.
Interesting.
Huh. Yep.
Oh, well, I guess the update at the bottom is positive. Google is working with Microsoft to resolve the issue. But it's really interesting to me that this even happened at all.
You would think that Google would kind of provide those codes and the APIs to someone like Microsoft?
Well, I'm surprised. It sounds like it's Microsoft developing it. I would have thought that Google would have put out their own app for Windows. Like, Apple doesn't write the YouTube app for iOS, do they?
No. But you know what? There's an updated story as well. Microsoft's claiming these things are manufactured. The search giant's objections are nothing other than excuses. It's interesting. There's a blog posting, actually. Microsoft's deputy general counsel, David Howard, did this, and I'm just opening it up now. The limits of Google's openness, as he calls it. We'll actually throw that one up, too. That looks interesting. It's a fairly long thing because he's a lawyer. No offense to our lawyer friends, but it's a lawyer.
I'm sure they'll understand.
So we'll throw that up. Well, I'm throwing that up. Why don't you go on to our next story, Jameson?
This is hilarious. I'm excited
okay.
for this.
Okay, so Facebook has had issues in the past of people hacking it, etc., and they haven't always responded in time, but they usually respond eventually.
Well, they actually say. They say, let us know if there's a bug, and we'll pay
exactly.
$500.
Exactly. So a hacker found a bug, and they didn't do anything, and he decided, well, if I can hack into Facebook, he went straight to Zuckerberg's wall and changed it. And put the hack up there.
That's brilliant. So
you know
smart.
What? You know how often that happens in corporate culture, though? So something like this, until you actually make the big guy aware,
yeah.
then all of a sudden things will start moving.
Yeah, exactly. But it's interesting to see it happen, and it's also interesting to see that, well, maybe Facebook isn't taking some of their security issues quite so seriously.
And the thing is, they're not even going to give him the $500 because he said he didn't do it using a test account. Come on.
Yeah.
I love this. Sorry for breaking your privacy. I had no other choice after all the reports I sent to the Facebook team. Absolutely brilliant that this guy did this.
It's a case of a white hat. I do hope that he sees his money out of this. That not to say shame Facebook into giving him his money, but at the same time, he didn't end up doing anything too super malicious. He didn't.
No, he could have done a hell
he
of a lot.
He could have been
sheep porn.
Well, and that's just it. He could have done something that was far worse. Instead, he just put up a simple notification saying, "I had to do this because you guys weren't paying attention to the reports I was sending in.
I had to do this because your team were being twits."
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
And then it's amazing how quick that thing.
I love Facebook's new reaction. We will pay out any future reports from him if they are found to be demonstrated
within
our
guidelines.
Yeah, you have to do it within your guidelines. In other words, don't let the boss know that we screwed up.
No kidding.
Yeah, but that's a little late.
Yep.
Oh, well.
Okay, moving on. Our next story. You know, this is pretty cool. Google goes down for 5 minutes. Web traffic plunges by 40%.
This is hilarious.
I bet most of this is YouTube.
This statistic is unbelievable. I really enjoy it.
Friday night, there was a brief, 5 minute that everything on Google services were unavailable. If you check their dashboard, it proves that.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, 40% of the web traffic dropped by 40%.
40% of all web traffic died.
Is something to do with Google. Exactly. And I bet a lot of that's YouTube by pure volume.
Email,
Google Search, Gmail, Google Drive.
Yep.
Even that includes. I mean, that includes basics, the weather apps.
Yep.
I mean, everything.
Well,
that's,
maps.
And let's talk about this. Like, how reliant? Maps. You know, how reliant are we now on Google? Let's imagine that instead of the word Google, it was Microsoft. Or you know, imagine how people would feel differently.
If you forced us to. It wouldn't be too difficult to come up with replacement tools for everything Google's provided.
With the exception of the data that was lost.
Right. Okay. No, I'll give you that. If there's something in the cloud and the cloud goes, Google's going to give me 6 weeks to tell me they're going to shut down. And
yep.
If you give me that time frame, you tell me Google's going to disappear, and I can probably go out of my way to make everything go according to plan.
Pull all your emails off.
You pull your emails.
Copy all your
but
content.
But it still shows how reliant. Look what happened when they decided to end, when they decided to drop Reader.
Right. No.
Yeah. Look at the scrambling people did, and it just shows how reliant we are.
The popularity of Google, I think. I mean, I like Google. They're a great company. They seem to they do good stuff. But the popularity of Google is largely based on how they have everything together in one spot.
And they make it simple.
Yes. And your one account gets access to dozens of services that are all incredibly useful. Other companies are catching up, and now, you know, Microsoft's got Outlook.com paired with SkyDrive, paired with they have whoever they acquired for Maps.
Yep.
Microsoft's got a whole great plus Bing.
Bing.
They've got their whole thing together now, but Google did it first.
Yeah.
And
I think the problem is then
there.
once you're established, it's tough to want to move things because everything's in one place. For example, their Chrome browser. I love the fact, particularly for me, because I run on two platforms, PC and Mac, and that if I add an add-on or a bookmark on one on the Mac version of Chrome, it syncs automatically. Next time I fire up the PC version, there it is.
I feel like such a moron for not realizing this was a thing so much longer ago.
Oh, yeah.
I discovered Chrome for iPhone like 2 weeks ago. And the number of times...
Where have you been?
I don't know. But the number of times that I've thought to myself, hey, I'm... You know, I pick up an article and I start reading it on my phone and I put it away and I think to myself later, hey, I should read that article. And I'm sitting at home and I finish it on my phone instead of on my computer because I don't want to be bothered to navigate to it. I it's happened a lot. I mean, there's been a bunch of times where I've thought to myself, I wish I could transfer this URL to that device.
And you know what? Google heard you and they responded.
And they responded months probably before I figured it was a thing. And I was so embarrassed when I discovered this. It's such an incredible service.
But if that went away.
It's so simple.
But if that went away.
Then I don't know if I could replace that one in particular. But in general, Google's services are available elsewhere.
Yep.
We've become reliant on them because they did it first. And I think that's almost the whole story for that, because if Microsoft had all these services conveniently designed, right, because it's Microsoft, and in one place,
or even Yahoo,
would they be as popular because they were Microsoft? Google started, you know, they really were on that "we're not evil" mantra,
right?
You know, and that also I think played a part.
Yep.
I think if Microsoft had come out at the same time, I don't think they would have had the amount of take up.
That's probably true. And the other company that's kind of doing it is Apple, and Microsoft did have to play catch up to Apple's iCloud service, which was another good conglomeration of all of these things. But at the time that iCloud was introduced, even Apple was reliant on Google, and to an extent still are. Do either of you two use Apple Maps when you navigate on your?
Actually, I do.
Liar.
No, I do.
Liar.
The only reason why I use Google Maps is because of the transit integration.
The other thing you should be using Google Maps for is points of interest. You can't tell, well, maybe you can now. Last time I used Apple Maps, which wasn't that long ago, you can't tell Apple Maps to find you a landmark, at least not in London. Yeah. You have to give it an address. Google Maps knows landmarks.
Yep.
Take me to Althaus College. Google gets me there. Apple Maps won't.
Fair enough.
Now,
that being said, I'm a very avid Foursquare user, so 9 times out of 10, I might not use either, and I'll use Foursquare instead.
Foursquare.
So, I mean, I'm maybe not the best person to ask on that, but it's still one of those things where...
Stuart, you're checking to see if you're mayor of the Unlab?
No, I'm checking to see... Well, my Foursquare. Yeah, it's important. You say that. I use Foursquare.
Anyways, that's... Google really did have it first, and you're probably right. The evil corporations probably could not have secured the same position.
Right.
But now that Google has it, there is a huge reliance. I think we could migrate away from it if we absolutely had to.
And I guess the question is it wise to be relying on that? As I said before, you know, in the cell phone space, I believe in competition.
Right.
You know, I believe for many of their things, like there's competitors to Google Drive. There's two or three.
Absolutely.
And I've used them, and they're very good.
And mm-hmm. I prefer Dropbox to almost anything else.
Yeah,
right
I'm
now.
Using Dropbox and SpiderOak.
And I prefer, honestly, I prefer Outlook.com's layout and usability to Gmail.
Yeah, but you're weird.
Well, fine. I'm weird.
Actually, I'm with Adam on this one.
No, you know what? They've done a lot to improve it.
But
my main problem is with Outlook.com, just like the old Hotmail, the amount of spam that leaks through the filters is unbelievable.
But if I set up my own filters, and I have, I don't get any. It's
but
see, I don't have
I will,
with Gmail.
But I will take Gmail's IMAP support any day
exactly.
over Microsoft's
yep.
lack of,
yep.
of IMAP
that's the
support.
Other
fair enough.
Yep.
So it's a catch 22.
Yep.
But I mean, the other company that's trying to play catch up that we're completely ignoring is Yahoo.
Who?
Yahoo.
They've been playing the game really well the last 6 months or so.
Well, they've been
not,
playing
not
it they very well.
Now they have on board as CEO, I think they're bringing some fresh ideas to the table.
They might. And, I mean, once upon a time, I didn't do Google searches. I did Yahoo searches.
Yep.
I mean, honestly, 12-year-old Adam was probably a bigger Yahoo. Well, I'm probably going back farther than Google even existed. I think Yahoo was around as a search engine before Google
Yahoo was. Yahoo was around way, way before. And before that, we used AltaVista.
Oh, my God.
AltaVista.
That was probably my very first days on the internet because I did use AltaVista. But no, Yahoo was an incredible service for a long time. They fell off the face of the earth largely because Google was doing what they were doing only better. And now that Yahoo's done the work to get themselves back up, I think they're a little more of a force to be reckoned with. However, when it comes to your data, you don't move it around too much. Switching emails is like switching phone numbers. I mean,
it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, you don't do that. I know people who hate their ISPs but use their ISP-provided internet email address.
Because they don't want to have the hassle of changing it.
And won't switch to a better ISP or a cheaper ISP because they don't want to lose their at whatever.
And you know what I tell these people? I say, get your own domain email.
That's what I've done.
Or get a Gmail. Yep. And then you never have to worry. You can change ISPs at will.
Absolutely.
But if Gmail goes down...
Well, not even. It's the same problem as if Gmail goes down. These people are so established in what they've already got that it's too much of a hassle for them to bother switching.
Yep.
Again, if Google gave us some notice and said, by the way, Google's shutting down, we had a good run, I think that people could adapt and figure out how to get all their stuff somewhere else. But, you know, if Google just one day shut everything off, we're going to lose 40% of our internet traffic.
Yeah,
people are not prepared to lose this behemoth who owns all of these conglomerate services.
And what would happen is there would be a period of chaos or whatever, but you know, other services would do the tech. People would have to change their email addresses.
Right.
You know, other video services are out there. Mm-hmm. You know, there is alternatives, but yeah.
It would take a long time.
It would be a heck of a period. Like, I look at myself, my own, you know, business emails and that, I use Google services for them for the back end. You know, yeah, there would be some, everyone would have to do some work.
Yep. So it's still something, it's interesting to ponder, but at the same time, it's one of those things where, well, we can live without 5 minutes of Google.
But after that, people get twitchy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
exactly.
True.
It's almost as bad as Facebook. If Facebook goes down for 5 minutes, some people.
Yeah.
Very twitchy.
Not quite as bad.
Not quite as bad.
I don't know, you talk to some of them. Anyway, all right.
Yeah, well.
ClassUp raised $100,000 on Indiegogo. But PayPal, refusing to pay up. Tell us about this one.
This is a little different. I've never heard of this before. So this company, GlassUp, has been producing kind of heads-up display-type products similar to Google Glass longer than Google has been doing it, or at least longer than Google's been saying they've been doing it.
Yep.
And they're at a point where they want to, you know, create a product. So they do what apparently is the thing that you do now. They went and they got it crowdfunded. They opened. They wanted $150,000. They're nowhere near the end of their campaign, and they've raised about $100,000 of it. And PayPal has shut them out.
Now there is a thing breaking in the story that does say that PayPal has now agreed to release the funds. But
so that just broke.
But you got to wonder why they were doing this in the first place. Were they receiving pressure from Google? Were they going?
I think it's PayPal acting like a monolithic bank. I swear they hired some people who are totally inflexible, from some of the big banks. That's the only thing I can think of sometimes. Because every time this happens, they end up looking like a bad guy. But the problem is, there isn't a decent competitor out there.
There's no one else. They're really the only player in this particular game. There's some interesting cases here, part of the same article. Not the first time PayPal has caused massive problems with projects and companies that catch fire. PayPal froze a charity account in 2011 and required massive documentation before releasing funds.
Didn't they also freeze the WikiLeaks, Julian Assange's stuff for WikiLeaks?
I do remember. I think I recall something along those lines. The other example they use is actually when PayPal froze $750,000 that was going to Mojang. Oh, no, it wasn't even Mojang. It was in Notch's personal account. After a vague, unexplained, quote, suspicious withdrawal or deposit, end quote.
And for people who don't recognize the name Mojang, that's the person who developed Minecraft.
Minecraft, excuse me, absolutely. Thank you. But it's so interesting that it's It's interesting that part of the article explains that Kickstarter refuses to use PayPal.
I wonder why.
Kickstarter is kind of the big player in the crowdfunding market. I think a little more than Indiegogo. But it's interesting that we've got people deliberately avoiding them now, and it's no surprise if your biggest player is being this much of a hassle for people.
Yeah. But you gotta wonder why, though, they're doing this, other than they just really are trying to position themselves as the digital bank.
I don't know, but like you got to wonder about some of these rules and that. Like I think the problem is sometimes, you know, and look at all the cases people have with PayPal and eBay. There's just some really crazy things, and I think sometimes you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But you know, there needs to be a little bit of, you know, more explanation. And I know some people have got, you know, burned on some of these Kickstarter campaigns, and people have to remember these Kickstarter campaigns aren't guarantees.
Well, and the thing that I think a lot of people are actually now trying to use Indiegogo more is because Kickstarter is either you receive all of your funding or you don't.
Right.
Whereas with Indiegogo, you can do it. You can do a campaign like the one for Glass Up, where if they don't receive all of their money, they still get what has been raised.
But then people have to realize when you're doing that, you're funding a project. You're not buying a product.
Yeah,
guarantee.
Right.
There are no guarantees, and that's one of the biggest problems we were having
after Pebble. We're going to come back to Pebble later, but after the success of Pebble, there was a little bit of discussion in the business world about how people have to be careful with crowdfunding websites because you're not actually buying anything; you're contributing in hopes that you get something down the line. Glass Up is in a particularly interesting spot. It looks like, and I really enjoy this. All of the press they've been getting regarding this PayPal stuff,
right,
has actually got them some investors.
Well, exactly.
So
yeah.
even if they don't reach their funding goal, they've put up an announcement on their Indiegogo page. We will deliver these products even if we don't reach our target. We have found investors,
which is a good thing.
We're in agreements with a variety of eyewear brands, so the final design will actually be trendier. It's interesting that that's what's come out of this, but that is kind of part of crowdfunding is. And it's one of the reasons I'm going to be the biggest hypocrite in, because there's proof that I've crowdfunded on my arm right now, but I as a general rule, I'll refuse to do it. I will not crowdfund
right.
something because I can't stand the idea. I would rather buy it after release knowing that I'm purchasing a product than chipping the money in advance.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and there's been some interesting, also in the gaming and hobby world, there's been some fairly good crowdfunding.
Yep.
And you know, it depends where it's coming from. Like, you know, if it's a big manufacturer, like Steve Jackson Games done some stuff and some miniature
sure.
makers. If you know the company and they're standing behind it,
yep.
you know, and they're using...
And they've got a list of stuff that they have already released.
Well, and one of it is there a lot of companies now are starting to use the crowdfunding. A lot of independent board game makers, particularly the war
yep.
game crowds, a company called GMT, I'm going to go a little bit off tech here, they produce a lot of board-based war games. Well, what they do is, the problem is it's a very, very niche market. So what they do is they have a program now called the P500 program. So it's essentially a very similar concept. So what happens is the company will, you know, release a mock-up of the game. They'll say, this is what it's going to be. This is who's made it. You know, this is roughly what we're going to look at. We need 500 people to commit to it for us to send it to the printers.
Yeah.
And then once they have that 500, people can continue and they'll base their numbers off that. So a lot of companies have taken that. And the crowdfunding thing is kind of a similar approach on
yep.
some things, but you've got to be really careful. Like, I agree with you. There's some stuff that's still kind of iffy tech. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm very hesitant. But if it's yep. like, you know, if it's something like someone's coming up with a new line of minis, but it's a very niche thing.
That's
once they get it, I know these guys are going to come through, then I will contribute to that.
The minis are an interesting...
That's like a pre-order.
The minis are actually an interesting example. There was a company about a year ago called Reaper Miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
And Reaper...
I missed that one by just a few days. I was so annoyed.
Reaper put up a Kickstarter. They were asking for $30,000.
Yeah.
And they raised over $3 million. And what it was you had to chip in, I think it was about $100. And your $100 got... I'll take a step back. Reaper Miniatures is an established miniature company. They make
yep.
minis for D&D style games.
And they've got a proven track record. They're a very good company.
Yes.
Yeah. Their casting is fantastic.
And what they wanted the money for was some new dies so they could cast new shapes and models. And so they really only needed $30,000. They said,
Not much. We
already have it. We just need to get these dies made. And that's what we want to do. And so what they ended up doing was they had a level. And the level was about $100, and for $100, what you initially got was one or two of all of the new two or three dozen different miniatures they were trying to make. And miniatures run, they can run $4 or $6 each. So,
yeah.
So getting...
It's pretty reasonable.
Getting 50 or... Getting, I think it was close to 30 or so for your $100 was not unheard of. That was pretty good. I have a friend who actually got in on this just before it closed off. By the time they finished, they hit so many stretch... Every time they hit a stretch goal, they threw one or two more miniatures into the list.
I'm just showing these guys the list here on the thing.
So
you started with the basic one, and then it just went...
Yeah, just keeps going and going and going. And by the time it finished, I think your $100 got you 125 or 130 miniatures.
Wow.
And you should also kick in, and you were getting some good deal on some really huge ones.
Absolutely.
And again, yeah, I was annoyed because I love mini painting, and I was just a day late.
One of the options was... They have a Reaper has their mascot Sophie, and they have every time they do a promotional thing, they put out a new Sophie model, and this one was Sophie riding a motorcycle, and my buddy that bought it didn't want Sophie riding a motorcycle. If you turned her in,
you bugger.
If you turned her in,
uh-huh.
you could get $25
yep.
towards something else.
Well, and they have stuff like like they were adding like an undead giant,
yep.
which is normally a $40 mini. If you're taking part in this Kickstarter, you'd just contribute $10.
Yep. So they took their $25 and they bought $25 worth of miniature like briefcases.
Yep.
So they got four or five of these mini carrying briefcases for nothing extra at the expense of the one model they had no interest in.
Yep.
And they got 130 miniatures in the cases to put them in. I mean, it was perfect for people who are trying to get started in D&D, people who love to play D&D, anyone who likes painting anything. I mean, it was an incredible...
$30,000 goal. They ended up getting $3,429,235. Yep. You know what? Speaking of Reaper, you should try and see if you could talk to one of for Project Play. Get one of the game stores. See if they can get a couple of reps.
Ah, I'll have to talk to them.
That would be nice. I'm just saying, I'm being biased here.
Anyways,
regardless,
the whole point behind this though is that's a company using a crowdfunding program effectively and giving back to the community instead of just saying, "Hey, we're going to take X amount of money and anything else on top of that is gravy."
Right. Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's hit or miss.
That's one of the incentives, I think, for Kickstarter is stretch goals are becoming such a popular thing now.
Well, and I think what happens with these Kickstarter, it really shows companies, and again, like the board game companies have done, particularly in niche markets, it allows them to see what sort of audience they're going to get. And I see this in the hobby industry a lot. I've seen some of the hobby stores, if a new model kit comes out, a lot of stores now are taking advantage of things like social media and that by saying, oh, if you pre-order it, the latest new kit, we'll give you 10% off. So the store knows exactly how many to order.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
know, so that sort of aspect. So, you know, so yeah, you know what? That's going to make me go back. I'm already going back to Indigo, see what other mini offers they have. But let's keep going with the show. We'll have to do a gaming or a board game show.
Yes,
sometime.
We will.
Yeah, I guess we just lost tech a little bit, didn't we?
Yeah, didn't we?
Ah, well.
We kind of all showed our inner geek. That's all right. I didn't know you were a minis guy.
I'm really not. I played D&D for a little bit there.
Attaboy.
I enjoyed my 4th edition D&D quite a bit.
Now, you realize it doesn't compare to 1st edition advanced D&D.
Well,
sorry, there's my curmudgeon-y coming out
again. If I can get myself back into a campaign again, what I want to start playing is D&D Next. They've started... you can be a beta tester for the new version. It's pretty easy. You go and put your email address into a form, and they basically give you the books, everything they've released so far for it.
And we should point out Gen Con was this weekend, was last week, and there's some pretty cool picks coming
out. So, I mean, I played it for a while. Miniatures really aren't my thing, but I was the one who set my buddy onto that particular one, and my buddy, who is a big D&D guy, jumped on
that.
Oh,
yeah. No, because, again, I have a few in my collection. They make beautiful minis.
Yep.
Anyway, moving on. Social media shaming, and I think, we should... This is definitely from our good friend Carmi.
Yeah, this is from our good friend Carmi Levy, who...
And I like this because it's kind of matches something what I did this weekend.
Really?
I did a Twitter shame.
Oh.
Similar concept. Actually, me and someone else did it, too. But continue and I'll...
All right, so the idea behind it is that there have been some fairly high-profile cases cropping up recently of people turning to social media to essentially shame someone or to... expose someone in public. So the most recent one in the United States was a gentleman in Reno, Nevada, dined and dashed. And
from several places.
And someone took his picture and posted it up on Facebook. And the police recognized it. And he was actually on probation. So he got arrested, etc., blah, 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 blah. But it's the issue it comes down to, in this case, privacy. Because, you know, why was the person shaming that person for dining? I mean, yeah, dining and dashing, don't do it. It's not nice to the companies. But
you commit a crime, you have no rights.
The Canadian Tech Podcast would like to remind you that it does not condone dining and dashing.
Yes.
Or violence against such people dining and dashing.
But there have been other stories, and there's been... here in London, there was something cropping up on Twitter this past weekend of a letter that was posted through someone's
front door.
Yeah, that was actually
the person was in Oakville.
Oh, okay.
And it was kind of making the thing in there. Carmi has a link to the story. And yeah, this
person, and there's also the issue in Toronto of an employee.
One at a time.
Okay.
Yeah, let's finish this one first. So basically, there's a condo complex, and the grandmother has one of her grandchildren is very autistic. And occasionally babysits for the child or takes care of the child to give the child's parents a break. And, you know, it was funny because this weekend at Loblaws, there was a very autistic child with his mother, like an older teenage boy. And I tell you, your heart just sinks because it's, you know, especially when they get to that age and they get strong in that, it's a lot of work.
Yep.
And you can see if you need a break. Well, this grandmother was found a letter in her mailbox one morning. Very hate-filled, saying, why would you have this child here disturbing us? They should have been put down. Like, very, just totally, totally
I believe hate-filled. I believe one of the lines was, your child should be euthanized.
Yeah, something to that effect. It was, you know, very sad. So this has made social media. And, you know, if the police have been notified in that, but the question is if this person's identity ever comes out, like, what's going to happen there?
Yeah.
You know, and, like, not that I do not condone violence. You know, against people, you let the law of the land put it through. But, you know, myself, for example, this weekend, what really annoys me sometimes is, and actually Carmi had a recent article about this too, is that people that park in fire lanes, it always seems to be expensive cars, or they can't be bothered to find the parking space, mm-hmm. or whatever. So someone on Twitter had taken a photo of a car, and I was at Canadian Tire this weekend, and there was a discount rental truck, but a fairly long one. He was parked in a car bay. So his truck is blocking half the, you know, the laneway where you have to go through and park. So, you know, I posted a picture of it. And other people have done the same thing. And I think, you know, more and more when it's a clear case like that, and, you know, guess what? Photography is not a crime.
Yep.
I have every right to take that picture and do with it what I will. If you're not, you know, my own opinion is if you're not being a jerk, then we're not going to take a picture of you.
Well, and I know for quite a long time, it's been fairly common on Facebook for people to take pictures of people parking really stupidly in parking lots, like taking up two parking spots and posting it online.
Yep.
But Carmi did make, he was on television, I believe it was last night or the night before, and he did make some very good points about where does this cross the line of privacy?
Yep.
Being able to be identified without your permission, and that type of thing.
But again, it comes down to if you're in a public place, there is no expectation of privacy. It comes down to that.
And if you commit a crime, I mean, what's the difference between me putting a picture up on Facebook or Twitter and a wanted poster or an ad in a newspaper or the cops want to find you without your permission?
I'm not going to argue on the crime one. I agree with you on that one, because if you've committed a crime or you're wanted for something, your face should be plastered everywhere, because people should be aware of what's at least, even in our society where you are presumed innocent until found guilty, the police are at least looking for you for a reason.
Yep.
But for stuff like posting a picture of someone's car parked across two lanes, what if someone knows someone who has access to the DMV records and can find that person's...
But again, if the person hadn't parked across the two lanes...
But my point is, it's different... There's a difference between someone who's committed a crime and someone who's just going about their day being really stupid in their everyday life. But where do you draw the line in privacy and the expectation of potentially being targeted?
Here's my own take. And I'm a big guy for freedom. I'm a big guy for innocent until proven guilty and letting justice rule. I'm not for mob rule. But at the same time, I also think in society these days, we've had a lot of cases where, you know, I always remember the old saying, it takes a neighborhood to raise a child, okay? And I remember when I was growing up that if I got caught doing something, or if I was doing something stupid down the road, my parents would find out before I got home. because everyone knew each other in the neighborhood and everyone watched out for each other. The problem these days is there seems to be less of that, and there seems to be more of a blasé attitude. And I think if it's just like in New York in the, I think it was in the 80s or the 90s, they started really going after what we call the BS stuff, jaywalking, littering, stuff like that. But the way they did it is they said, if we start doing this, that it makes people more aware, and it tends to raise the awareness that, you know, there's certain things you don't do in society. And I think something like this, it sends the message, because guess what? You know, if there's someone out there doing this, then they're going to be less likely if they don't want to be embarrassed.
Yeah, if you don't want to end up on iparklikeanass.com, don't park like an ass.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... Okay, so there's a bit of an issue with privacy, but the world we live in right now, everyone's got a gadget, everyone can take a picture, and photography
is not
illegal.
And guess what?
Half
the time, you know, the stores themselves have the cameras. They're watching us.
Yeah, but
they're in the street. So what's the difference?
I guess my point is more the outlier of someone who might have access to be able to take that record and go to a grocery store, buy a bunch of eggs, and egg your house.
Then that's the fault of the person taking the information that's out there and doing something wrong with it. That is illegal.
That's
the act of photographing,
but
in public.
No, your other person just violated the law.
Yeah. But then it's a slippery gray slope. Where do you draw the line of culpability?
You don't violate the law.
Right.
But taking
a picture in a public parking lot, I'm not violating the law now.
But someone takes the information that you have posted. You are enabling someone to commit a crime.
That's not the fault of the photographer. No, that's not
the fault of the photographer. That's the person who violated the law. I'm not accessory to someone taking my picture and...
Could you then blame... Is that like someone saying, oh, I read a book by Tom Clancy on how to shoot a guy.
Yeah.
So I went out and shot him. Tom's charged?
Yeah, no, exactly right. I'm with you 100%.
Yep. No, you know what? And there's certain things, and there's laws with photography. For example, this is something that, you know, we've got so many various police forces and that using this to say, oh, it's against because you're a terrorist and stuff like that. Total BS. Part of it is, if you're in public, there is no expectation of privacy. In this country, you can freely take pictures of, let's say, our public officials,
mm-hmm.
police officers and that, working a scene, as long as you're not interfering with them.
Correct. To my knowledge.
No, it is. I've done the homework. For example, now, if I'm in White Oaks Mall, for example, and I start taking pictures, if a security guard comes up to me and says, it's the mall policy, you can't take pictures, okay, then I have to stop taking pictures. However, he cannot tell me to delete the photos, all right? He cannot ask to look at the photos. They are my property at that point. Now, if I become a jerk and I continue to take photos, they can issue a trespass order. At that point, they get me for trespassing. They don't get me for photography.
But that's because it's private property.
Right. So, but on a public street where there's no expectation, the only exceptions are if I'm walking down the street and I point a zoom lens into your window, that's different. That's cut and dry. But when you're out in public on a public street and it's been proven up to the Supreme Court of both U.S. and Canada,
yep.
there is no expectation for privacy. If I'm not using the photographs for commercial purposes and I shoot someone, I don't require a model release.
Yep.
If I just post it on Flickr, I'm not making money. I can shoot whatever. And people that think that don't, you know, it comes down to what it is, why they get angry, because they got caught.
Right.
Yep.
And, you know, that's
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just playing devil's advocate on this. So it's either way. It's still an interesting topic, and it's certainly something that seems to be cropping up a lot more.
We're seeing it a lot more, and what's happening is, you know, in social media, we just had a case recently where a reporter's partner for the Guardian newspaper was traveling through Heathrow Airport from a trip to Germany. And this is the partner of the reporter that initially broke the Edward Snowden case.
Yep.
UK Customs decided to hold this guy for the maximum of 9 hours under a terrorism charge. Asked him all sorts of questions, seized his cell phones and that, and then let him go.
Yep.
You know, and it's like you're going, okay, what's going on? You know, years ago that wouldn't have appeared, but now we hear about it. We have countless cases of people in the States and that, you know, they see law enforcement. Like, if we didn't have public photography and free freedom to shoot, would we hear about Rodney King? Would we hear about some of these other cases? You know, I always hate hearing the words, you know, if you don't do anything wrong, don't worry about it. But it has a lot of case. Like, the way I look at it, you go to England, you go to some places, there's 20 cameras on me. So it shouldn't make a difference.
That's a whole different argument about talking about closed caption cameras in public and stuff like that. But
they're in public. I have every right, you know, if I don't want to be on camera, I don't go out in public.
That one's a tough one to, because if you don't have the choice, that one comes down to if you don't have the choice about going out in public and not being watched.
There's no expectation of privacy. The big difference is if I take a picture of someone, let's say I take a picture of you and your wife, if I use it for commercial services, or for sales, I have to get a model release from you guys. But if it's for my own personal thing, if I want to throw it on Flickr, there's no money. I can shoot whatever I want.
No, I was more meaning the government-controlled closed caption where they're essentially observing.
But the question is we never know what they're doing with the data, et cetera.
Well, and that's my point.
It's cut and dry
that's what I am
and I'm not allowed to do with what I shoot.
Yes.
It's not. Okay. It's a far more cloudy on the other side.
I'm going to call this one.
All right.
We're going back over stuff we've already done, and we got 7 more stories to get through tonight.
Awesome.
You hear that? Adam's putting down his foot.
I'm putting my foot down.
All right, so the next one I added, this one cropped up, and it kind of made me shiver and cringe a little bit.
Yeah, this is kind of creepy.
So for a while now, Facebook has had the age limit of 13 years old for children signing up. And even then, I'm pretty sure you have to have parental consent.
Half the time they lie.
Well, that's a whole different story. Anyways, LinkedIn, everyone's favorite professional network, has decided to lower the age limit to 13. And my first thought on this is, so why? And my second thought on this is, do we really need to push children that much further? Because there's already a lot of pressure, at least in Canada, for children as soon as they enter high school to try and figure out what they want to do.
Because we're talking grade 7, 8, 9 here.
Yeah. Do we really need even more? But on the flip side, if you're thinking about it, well, if the school systems are pushing children towards making those decisions, why not open up? Why not have the tools available to them?
And I think this is what we're. I think you're basically seeing more of what the second thing. I think that's definitely what it is. It's giving them. I'm a little bit the creepy factor. Yeah, as you say, you've got someone 13 or 14 potentially talking to someone in first or second year university. We haven't got a lot
of
details.
Or 50
yet.
Years old and the CEO of a company.
You know what? And again, depending what it is, it's fine. Again, there's a lot of over paranoia over the, you know, stranger danger and all that crap.
Now, to LinkedIn's credit, it does look like they are trying to gear it towards education. So it's showing you sort of the path through.
Yeah, and there might be the people they're allowed to contact is very strictly defined. We're going to have to see how this plays out. The problem is now is you've already got kids much younger than, what's Facebook's age, 14?
13.
13, you've already got much younger than on Facebook.
Yep. Or you've got something like a parent signing up for a child when they're born to make sure that person, that name is...
And that doesn't bother me as much as if they're using it.
No.
I think it comes down to, you know, parental responsibility. I'm in my neighborhood, we've got several kids all around that age, and some have a Facebook account now and some don't. And, you know, to the parents' credit, the parents decide, you know, how responsible the child is. In one case, I know they allowed the daughter to have it on her 13th birthday, but it's very strict control. One of the things her father says is, guess what? You're making me a friend, and that way I can see whatever's going on. And, you know, they made it very clear, and there hasn't been a problem. My wife and I, other than her parents and her grandparents, and I think the aunts, my wife and I are the only other adults that are in that stream. It's kind of fascinating to see how the kids relate to these days, though. If you ever attempt to follow a 13-year-old's Facebook's timeline, it's very weird.
Yeah, my niece is that old, and it's a nightmare.
It's interesting.
So, yeah, well.
I think we'll have to wait and see what happens here.
It will be interesting.
Yeah, LinkedIn, I have to admit, I've got to spend more time with it. I do use it.
Well, and the article does bring up a good point, is that tweens are very, very good at internet stalking regardless.
Yeah.
So opening up the tools and making it essentially available legally for them to access. Mm-hmm. I use the term legally loosely here, but the opening up the tools for them is not necessarily inherently a bad thing.
I know the other thing was recently, I don't think it was on last week's This Week in Tech, Leo Laporte was talking to his 13-year-old son. He has some of his buddies over. And he was saying, okay, I just want to ask you for a few minutes. And the kids, a lot of them don't use Facebook now because mom and dad are on it.
Yep.
The big thing is Vine. It's, they jump to new things.
Because it usually takes a lot longer for parents and people of older generations to switch or to catch on.
Exactly. And the kids want their privacy.
Yep.
You know, so there we go. Okay, moving on to Windows.
I think this one's yours, Adam.
Is this one mine? Oh, is this my Windows story?
Yes.
This is your Windows 8.
I thought this was hilarious. So yes. Let me make sure I get it right. HWBot, which is one of the world's biggest benchmarking communities, has banned Windows 8 for any kind of benchmark because they can Windows 8 can be used to manipulate 3DMark, PCMark, and SuperPi results by virtue of the fact that there is an error in the real-time clock that keeps things keeps accurate track of the time when the computer is being used.
And I really have to ask, how the hell did this get out of QC?
I have no idea. This is really, really interesting to me. I'm not quite sure how it ended up happening. How this got through is beyond me. So it seems to be attached somehow to the processor speed of the cycle speed, I should say, of your processor. It's if your chip is overclocked, it causes the clock to run fast, and if you underclock your processor, it causes the clock to run slow. They give a great video where they show that over a 5-minute period, they can cause the Windows clock to run 18 seconds fast. 18 seconds over 5 minutes is 7 or 8% fast, which is
a lot. Now, I guess the question is, how did previous Windows OSs do this?
Good question, and I don't know the answer to that.
My guess would be at least some of them pulled it in from the motherboard.
So there must have been some steps taken to ensure that if the processor was being overclocked or there was an issue.
Right.
I wonder if it's the same in the Mac world.
I'm not entirely sure how this got taken care of when it was...
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
No, because this clock that it's referring to is the clock on the motherboard. In modern computers, the RTC is built into the South Bridge. In standalone RTCs, it's a package that contains its own built-in power supply.
Oh.
In the case of your PC, there's probably a button battery or a supercapacitor on the motherboard that keeps the South Bridge powered. That's absolutely true. Just about every motherboard I've ever seen has the button battery on it.
Yep.
And
if you pull that out, you're usually screwed.
The RTC, due to its implemented in-hardware nature, is very useful for providing a baseline for benchmarks. It's designed to keep pace with real-world time.
Except
unfortunately, Windows 8 isn't reliable. Microsoft made some changes to the timekeeping routines that allow for low-cost devices in embedded systems that don't always have conventional RTCs.
So it's
recent changes. It was working just fine.
Are you saying Microsoft went cheap?
Basically, if you change your CPU base clock frequency in software, not at boot time, it has a massive impact on Windows 8 ability to keep accurate time.
Huh.
That's it.
Interesting.
That's it.
By underclocking the clock of a Haswell system from 6%, they underclock it 6%, Windows 8 loses 18 seconds over a five minute period, which is also about 6%.
Yep.
That's a lot of time.
So that's exactly it. It's exactly in line with that. That's unbelievable. So you can't benchmark with Windows 8 anymore because you can manipulate it. Benchmarks don't help anybody if the numbers aren't accurate. So I guess that's the thing. If you can take your CPU and overclock it 50%, say, well, whatever the status, say, even 20%, you're going to have 20% more benchmark than any other system with the same configuration, and you're going to make it
seem that much better, even though it really isn't.
Correct.
Because ultimately, overclocking or underclocking is the user defined something. It's not a base change. Right. So,
all right,
let's wait and see what happens. Okay, yep. Move on.
Another Microsoft story. So Skype has for a while now replaced Messenger, etc. And it looks like Windows has confirmed that for Windows 8.1, which is bringing back some functionalities and
no big surprise.
Including functionalities, they're also going to include Skype as built-in. So it's not a huge surprise.
Now, weren't they also saying Skype was going to be kind of at least the text chat version is the replacement for Messenger?
Yes.
Yeah, so...
It already is.
Yeah, well, exactly. So this doesn't come as a huge surprise.
Yeah. It's kind of like them bundling other services or things like Internet Explorer built into the operating system.
Right.
Which is kind of nice because if you don't have to... If you have an 8.1... installation disk whenever those come out.
Well, it's also
like
nice because it's going to feature Outlook integration. So again, you have your single contact book, which kind of ties to everything.
Right.
So that's kind of nice.
Yep.
Nice too. I also heard something. We didn't put it in here, but I believe I've heard an October date for an 8.1 release.
I don't know if they've actually.
I heard something about
it
that.
It should
today.
Be coming up. I think they put out the RTM for it.
RTM's already out, so you know, again, maybe now they bring back a start menu.
Yeah.
You know, people will be fine. I had to look it at him when I said that.
Don't do this to me, Stuart.
I know. It's okay. It's okay. That's the one we agree to disagree. Okay. From the gaming side.
But yep. No, that's my problem. Hang on. I got to go back to that.
Oh, shit. Here we go.
That's the problem. is they're not bringing back the start menu.
They're bringing back something that looks like
they're
the
adding
start
a
menu.
Start button that will take you back yes. to your Windows 8 tiles interface.
That's
I would
fine.
Be on
I'll
board.
I'll still use Classic Shell.
I would be on board if they would give me a real start menu. I would be okay with them bringing that back.
But so I'm, you could choose between...
Yeah, but I'm not on yep. board with them going halfway and then giving me a button that just goes back to the
I'd
tiles.
Also be on board if some of my older classic Steam games would work. But that's a whole other battle.
Ooh.
Anyway, okay. Well, no, we should have one bit of news, too, is I now have an Xbox 360. A good neighbor of mine was getting rid of it, and he offered it to me. So, yeah, I've actually got to play around with it a little bit.
Stuart's using a console?
I know,
but you know what?
This.
You know what? The good thing that was good about it, he gave me two racing games, and I went down to Goodwill, and they had NHL 2007 for it, because that's what I used to play the hockey games. No, you know what? So far, I'm pretty impressed. Setup was pretty easy. You know, the way it integrates, although there was a funny bit. I go to create an Xbox Live account,
yep.
you know, the free one. It says, well, the email address is in use. And I'm going, how can that be?
Games for Windows Live?
Exactly. Yep. I had Grand Theft Auto 4. I had signed up for, after you signed up, you never had to use it again.
Which means you also have GamerScore, believe it or not, because you do get GamerScore from your PC games that support games for Windows Live.
Well, so there we go. But there was only ever the one, so right. I don't think I have much of a GamerScore. But anyway, let's go into Sony.
If you want another console, we got
in Canada first too.
That's right. It showed up at Future Shop last week.
Apparently we're a good test market.
They announced this for non-North American markets a year or two ago.
Yeah.
Never showed up here, never expected it to. There is a PS3 with 12 gigabytes of flash storage as opposed to 250 gigabytes of traditional hard disk storage. Now available at retailers for $199, which is the cheapest we've ever seen a PS3.
Yep.
It will probably
be around for a while.
Yeah. I'm a little bit shocked at how they implemented this, to be honest. The 12 gigabyte drive isn't modular flash storage like the 4 gigs is in a Xbox 360. It's an actual 2.5-inch SATA 12 gig solid-state storage drive, which blows me away because I don't know why you'd implement this way, but... Hey, here we are. So you can get a hard drive kit for it if you want. It's very easy to open up a PS3 and take the hard drive. It's designed to be done by your average Joe.
Yep.
You can take the 12 gigs out and put in 500 if you want, but you can't keep both.
You could attach an enclosure.
You're buying an enclosure and USB. No, now we're getting too complicated.
So basically, because again, this Xbox I got is a 60 gig drive, so I appreciate you can store some content. Is 12 gig enough for? What this market's aiming for?
12 gigs is probably enough for game saves.
And that's about it.
That would be about it. Okay. In fact, a lot of PlayStation games even feature mandatory installation.
I've noticed that there is, Forza Racing? It came with two discs, and it made you install the second disc.
And Halo 4 did that, too, more recently. You had to put 8 gigs of storage onto your hard drive.
A friend of mine was royally pissed off because he had the 4-gig Xbox and he couldn't play Halo 4 when it came out because he didn't have enough storage.
Yep. Last of Us, the very recent big blockbuster for PlayStation 3, I believe, has a few gigabytes of installation files.
Yep.
Metal Gear Solid 4, when it came out, I remember it being a big deal that you had to install a bunch of stuff. There's been a few games over the years that have come out for both Xbox 360 and PS3 where Xbox 360 users have laughed because the big gag is... I'm going to go home and, some PS3 players go home and press install and then go do something else. And the Xbox 360 owners go home and play. So you're really, 12 gigs is probably enough for a few of the mandatory game installations. Some games, they're just a couple megabytes. Some of them are a couple hundred megabytes, that would be okay.
Yep.
But in general, you're just looking at basic installs and game saves.
For some people, may not be that big a deal.
Yeah. And you can take advantage of all the media services that come along with it. Netflix and stuff will work no problem.
That's what I was going to say, is that this is...
Unless you want Netflix on an Xbox and you pay.
Oh.
But you can't, for example, with 12 gigs, realistically, you can't go to the PSN and download stuff like crazy. You want to download, even old PlayStation 1 games. If it's two discs, that's a couple of gigabytes.
Okay,
right there.
So what's the market for this?
People who are interested in getting into PS3 and don't want to spend the $300 that would normally be the entry. And I would say the other thing is people who have PlayStation 3s that have failed. If you can take the hard drive out of your old PS3 and pop it into a new one, it's a nice, easy way for them to have an inexpensive console on the market.
Good points.
Well, or for someone like me who I would love a Blu-ray player and having the media sharing features would be amazing.
PS3 media sharing is second to none.
And the ability to play the occasional PlayStation game, yep. Hey, bonus.
And, I mean, if you do really want to pick up some of these blockbusters, Last of Us, I'll bring it up again, sold a bunch of consoles. People yep. bought PS3s yep. to play Last of Us. Yep. This is a cheap way to do it if you only want to play one game.
Well, I have to admit, when I got the 360, I'm going to be keeping my eyes open for Halo 2 and the other ones in the title, because I did enjoy the first one when it was available on PC.
Check
only.
Used games at
well, that's
your
what
local.
I do, but I do know I suck at shooters generally.
Oh.
On those, I'm still I got to get used to the controller.
Don't play with my wife.
You're a married man, of course not.
Oh, that.
Oh, sorry, yeah, games. That, I wonder where he was going.
That
there.
Controller, when you adjust to it, there's still nothing better for me.
You, well, you know, and that's what I've heard. Controller. I've heard very good reviews. And no, I know your wife is a killer when it comes to video games.
Yeah.
She also swears a lot, too. But she also, I think she also wants a better PC that so she can play.
Yeah, that's next
we
on
should,
the list.
We should bring that up every week. I like this game.
Oh.
There you go.
Well,
there
let me put it this way. Last time we played Left 4 Dead, she had the best headshot ratio out of all four of us.
You know what? And I figured she's probably a badass. I don't know if I ever told you that. One time I was on a Skype call with Jameson, and in the background, you could hear Jameson's wife, like I said, swearing up a sailor. I thought he was in trouble. You know, then I realized, no, she was playing some sort of game.
Hilarious.
Like,
yep.
Oh, yeah. You know, now I know where these, like, Xbox Live trolls come from.
Oh.
You know, if they have to listen to that, she probably taught half of them, right? The language.
Hey.
Your wife's awesome. But that's
I'm going to feel pain later.
Well, unless she's listening, she's out of town right now, so
that's
you
true.
Might be all right for a while. Yeah, so that means you're bacheloring it, so you're bound to get into trouble anyway. So
yep,
that's fine. Okay, let's keep going.
This was one of mine. I noticed this, I guess, a year ago when they first started cranking out Retinas, because I was working around so many of them that there are two different display manufacturers for the
yes.
Retina display. And the Samsung display that is available looks and acts and behaves dramatically better than the LG panel.
I remember this ghosting issue.
And I hate to take a crack at LG because, in general, I love a lot of the stuff they
put out.
Yeah,
they do very good products normally.
But we've been seeing this a lot. Screen retention, ghosting, off color.
I'm pretty sure our friend Frank, who sometimes, Mike Batista, who sometimes is a guest on the show, had one that was doing that. It was
yep.
either
yeah,
him or Derek
yeah,
Martin.
Yeah, someone, one of the two of them had it, yeah.
When the news broke way back when, we had people returning Retina Pros to my store like crazy, trying to make sure they only bought ones that had the right brand panel in it.
How do you tell? Was there a way to tell? Serial numbers?
If you could tell it by serial numbers. That's exactly
okay.
right. Macs are good enough that when you go into About This Mac, you can find out. System information, not About This Mac, excuse me. When you go to system information, it gives you everything you need, including the serial number of the display. And so people were able to figure out exactly who their manufacturer was. Oh, it might not even been serial, it might have been the part number, but it doesn't matter. You were able to tell. So we got a lot of complaints, people wanting to make sure they only got the best one. And when you spend $2,300
you
on
wanna
a laptop,
yeah, you're
absolutely.
Gonna make sure, yeah, definitely.
Can't fault them for that.
This was certainly interesting to see that that this had happened. I don't understand that there's a well, I do understand why. It's hard to believe that it's come this far. There's a class action suit now. That's
yeah,
how
some
this
guys filed
up.
One. Yep.
You would think that be getting it replaced. I'm assuming he got it replaced, or Apple has offered him to replace
Apple
it.
Apple has no. When this became an issue, Apple claimed that this was not an issue. It was working correctly because that was the panel that was being used.
But I guess people could just walk into the Apple store and they were generally getting a replacement.
It could be. I've yeah. heard cases of people getting their units replaced with a new LG-enabled units yeah. and then having the same problem. So this is, if you've got an LG screen in your Retina Book Pro,
well, we'll have to keep an eye on this as it develops, but class action cases can take years.
You are in a class action suit.
Yep. But they can take years and you might end up... with a coupon for you know, a free small fries or something.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Only the lawyers win. All right. Last two stories. Elementary Teachers Union updating electronic device policy.
These are both mine. I guess I'll just dive
yeah,
right into
it. Go ahead.
I mean, Stuart just pretty much nailed it. The Elementary Teachers Union ETF has officially, ETFO, as they're, you know, known, has they've updated their electronic device policy to prevent personal electronic device use in their classrooms, except in situations where teachers specifically give a student permission to use it. So that means that students going into elementary school starting September the 4th or whatever the first day of school is this year are not allowed to use cell phones or any other personal
iPods.
Electronics. Yeah,
yep.
It's simply not allowed in the class. This is probably overdue. I'm actually surprised it's gotten this far.
And I think you'll see a lot of leeway. For example, you know, if I'm a teacher, yeah, in my class, no. But let's say
in
at
the
lunch
hallway?
Hour. Yeah, maybe in the hallway or at lunch hour so you can turn on and see if mom and dad's sent you a text message to say you're going to be late picking up little Johnny.
What I'm surprised is why school boards are, when they're putting in Wi-Fi, why they're not putting in Wi-Fi and cell phone signal blockers and just programming it so that it turns on during instructional time, turns off.
Cell phone jammers are against the law.
Yeah, cell phone jammers are against the law, and there is a case to be made, even though the odds of it happening are very low. But if they do have a lockdown with an incident, sometimes they have been useful for, you know, a teacher or a child saying, oh, there's six of us in this classroom.
Yep. But surely there has to be a way for programming it so if the school does go into lockdown, it automatically lifts the restrictions.
Not really, because it's normally a switch. I think this is a good compromise. It's
fair
no
enough.
Different than, you know, when I was in school, you couldn't have your Walkman on.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. You know, and I think it depends, you know, how it'll come down to the board level or the individual teacher level. You know, if I was a principal, I'd be saying, yeah, you know, in between class or, you know, at lunchtime or right after school, yeah, turn it on. But during class, no, you don't need it.
I don't have any problem with ETFO doing this. If remember, this is ETFO. This is the elementary teacher.
This is the elementary teacher.
These are students 12 years of age and down.
Yep. And they've you already see quite a few kids in grade 7 and 8 who have these things.
You absolutely do. But at that level, I almost think, like, you can't trust the students not to be able to use them when they really need to. Even in high school,
high school is open season.
Cell phone use was becoming a thing when I was graduating high school.
Same.
By the time I started working in high school, it was everywhere.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when I was working in a high school, it was impossible to try and prevent people from using anything.
You know, in a classroom environment, I can see it. You can tell the kid, you know. But, to outright ban them, I have an issue with that. You know, even though we've got helicopter parents who want to know what little Johnny's doing and all that. But I think, as you say, at the elementary level, during lunch hours, after class, flip it on. They can get their text message, you know, because I can see them. I can see the soccer mums or the helicopter mums, you know, saying, oh, but what if I have to tell them I'm going to be late from one class and I have to pick them up for soccer at the other door? Well, again, they flip on the text message comes through when they take it out of airplane mode.
Right.
Exactly.
Not to mention the parent could theoretically just call the school and let the kid know.
That's how schools worked once upon a time.
Yeah.
So I actually don't see. I'm gonna say
actually,
that,
but
that,
in some ways,
that
some
banning
schools...
that banning it is when you already have those types of systems established.
You
and
know what?
The kid has to get called down to the office
I'll
for
tell
a
you
message.
A story. I'll tell you a story though. They've had some schools. I've heard stories from teachers before cell phones really came in. They used to have issues. They'd have to stop parents from calling because they were acting like the messenger service for their kid. You know, so there's a fine line, like anything else. All right, last story.
I can't believe we haven't addressed this yet, given the Indiegogo campaign is almost over. But since we are talking about crowdfunding night, it seems like the right time to do it. Canonical, which is one of the companies out of Europe, they make Ubuntu. They've tried to develop a phone. They've come up with the Ubuntu Edge, which is supposed to be a phone that's going to be running Ubuntu Mobile, which when docked becomes full version Ubuntu, which means if you're a Linux user, you now have your PC experience with you everywhere.
Well, not only that, you have your entire PC with you.
That's the expectation.
Well, and this is interesting. It seems to be the natural progression. It makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it does. So they've got this top tier. Basically what happened was, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, whoever owns Canonical came out and said there's no Formula One equivalent in cell phones. In cars, when someone comes up with something new, they send it out to F1 or NASCAR or one of the big car racing, you know, organizations. That's what I'm looking for, organizations. And they try it. And if it works well, they trickle down and eventually that feature becomes a real feature in a real car. But there is no F1 for cell phones.
Right.
So what they need is people who are interested in becoming, you know, groundbreakers to contribute and be part of a revolution in cell phones. So they pitched this phone, this 4.5-inch phone with, you know, a high-def display, a sapphire glass screen, 128 gigs of internal storage, 4 gigs of RAM, a quad-core processor, I mean, the whole bit. Even a battery technology that nobody else has used. And by nobody, I mean nobody. There are no commercial devices in existence right now that use a silicon anode lithium ion battery. You want to know how I know that?
How do you know that?
I'm getting a master's degree in battery science, and I can tell you that's not a thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, are we sure you're getting a master's degree?
Well, we'll find out on Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
The relevant thing here is that they're really stepping it up. They're going ahead with all these new techs that nobody is using. And... they put it out to Indiegogo. They said, you people need to fund it because you need to be the diehards that want it to become a thing. They had different levels available all the way up to an $80,000 enterprise bundle. They had 50 of those available.
I think I'm a few dollars short on that.
Yeah, you got, well.
The more impressive part is that one person has signed up for that.
Oh, yeah. I forget who it was. They got I think it was Engadget or someone, one big firm came out and said, okay, we'll put the $80,000 down. And for the $80,000, you get 115 phones. And so you can redo your entire business using Ubuntu Edge phones. It's a remarkable phone, and I would love to get my hands on one, except it doesn't exist.
Well, so exactly.
They were going to do the work to make it exist using the $32 million they were counting on getting, and they did
we should know. As of right now, 54 hours to go, $11.6 million.
That's invested, not to go. They're at $11.6 million.
And unfortunately, they have marked this one as either we get it all or we get nothing.
Correct, because they needed it all. They had no interest in getting part of the funding. They needed it all.
But it certainly brings the model, because I think if you look at other companies, they may look at this and they went, hey, there's a lot of money raised. You know, again, the idea makes you look at more and more with portable computing. I carry a phone.
Yep.
I carry my Mac. Wouldn't it be great is if my iPhone could do everything my MacBook does, but I can plug a monitor in and all that?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
But then the problem becomes essentially sharing monitors wherever you go.
We'll set up docking stations.
But I'm saying
You'd have to set up essentially an infrastructure for that.
But for some people, it makes a good case. If they're going between home and work, It makes a lot of sense.
It's plugged in at home. Yep. They pop it out. They go on the road. When they get to the office, they plug it into another screen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
To the credit of the people over at Ubuntu, this is officially the most funded crowdfunding campaign in the history of crowdfunding. They recently stole the torch away from the Pebble smartwatch, which last May managed to get $10.4 million. The Ubuntu Edge is currently sitting at $11.6 million. However, I'm not sure if that record gets to stand when 54 hours from now, the whole record of it gets wiped.
Yeah.
I would love to see this thing become.
It would have been great. It would have been a great device.
Well, you just have to come up with 20-something million.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You go ahead and invest the $20.5 million remaining, and you, too, can get an Ubuntu Edge.
Maybe one of them could talk to Elon Musk.
Yeah, right. Secretly, I think they didn't want this to succeed. They were counting on $1 million a day.
Yeah, I think I think it's a way to get some people out thinking about it.
Yep.
Yeah. So I
agree. And I'm surprised that stuff like the Sapphire Glass, that one's known to be relatively expensive. When they probably could have gone with something like Gorilla Glass, like they certainly weren't cheaping out on this.
Well, that was the whole point, was we're going to do everything top end.
Well,
and
the other thing
we
can think about is this may just be something that's 5 years ahead of its time.
Yes.
Yep.
You know, we've seen that before with the Newton and other things like that.
But, Jamie, the point of this was
I know.
This is, compared to the iPhone, this is a Formula One car.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the point. So, they were going to go all out, for sure.
Okay, before we get to picks of the week, anything new on the Project Play front?
We closed the volunteer sign up on Sunday.
Okay.
So we're going to be contacting them yesterday, I should say.
All right.
So we're going to be contacting all of our wonderful volunteers that have signed up to help out this year. And we're continuing to get vendors and other groups lined up to make it an awesome
day. Did you also launch a Facebook page? You did something else.
Oh, Facebook event.
Facebook event page.
Which has links to buying tickets as well as sort of a general overview.
Okay, make sure you throw that in the show notes.
I will definitely show that.
Excellent. So, and you'll be letting us know, because I'm sure there'll be more awesome announcements coming.
Oh, yeah.
But the date's coming quick.
September 22nd.
I was looking at my calendar
today. Get your tickets, $10.
Get your tickets. And best of all, you can come and meet all of us.
Exactly.
You know, at some point, we'll be in the podcast studio. Yeah, Adam, we didn't tell you, but you are coming.
Oh, goody.
Okay, just so you know.
All right, I'll book it off work.
There you go. Well, I assumed Jameson or already told you that you're coming.
Nobody's wrote me anything yet, but I'm happy to be there.
You have to be there.
All right, and when's the date again?
September 22nd.
At?
At the Fanshawe Student Center.
Be there or be square?
Be square.
All right,
picks of the week.
I'm going to go first because mine is the least interesting. I bought my new laptop in May. I have intermittently complained about the Wi-Fi reception that my laptop gets.
And by intermittently, you mean a lot?
A lot. Particularly at home. My Wi-Fi seems to work fine some places, but particularly at home, it seems to be a big issue. which isn't good when I can't use my laptop wherever I want at home. So I did a little research, and I discovered that the Intel 6235N wireless card is notorious for being bad like this. And Intel blames the manufacturers and says they're just not seeding the card correctly. And the manufacturers blame Intel and saying, no, you're manufacturing a faulty card. Different users are having different experience with different drivers.
And you wonder why we didn't install a router.
And I said, well, I'm not going to screw around with this anymore. One of the things I was most disappointed about in this laptop was not having wireless AC when I knew that the new Macs were going to have it less than 3 weeks later.
See, you should have bought a Mac.
I guess. Or, for $30, I could go to my local computer store and buy an Intel 7260 AC wireless card. And so I installed that in this guy today. Turns out this laptop is a huge pain in the butt to open, but got it. Installed it, had no problems, compatible with the other antennas. I still get Bluetooth. I still get WiDi, which is something I wanted. And now my laptop is 1,100 megabit per second capable.
So much that he was complaining when we're going to get AC.
That's right.
Here at the Unlab.
I would love 1,100 megabits here at the Unlab.
But as I told him, he's quite welcome to buy us a router. Because, you know, I'm sure he can get a discount somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. It solved the problem. Seems to be great. I'm grateful Intel got this one right.
Awesome.
Good card from Intel. Intel 7260 AC.
Very cool.
Excellent. Okay, you're up
next. I guess I'm up next. So this past week, PopCap finally released after giving no release date and hyping. EA PopCap.
They do this to wind you up.
I know. Anyways, Plants vs. Zombies 2 is finally out. And actually, you raise a good point, Adam. I know a lot of people that were not looking forward to this because it was being released by EA PopCap. PopCap obviously hit the nail on the head with the first Plants vs. Zombies, and then they got bought out because of their success, etc. I think they got bought out a while ago, but it's recently EA has been going downhill. So they finally put out Plants vs. Zombies 2. I love the game so far. It's awesome. It is a freemium model game. Unlike the first one where you played it through to unlock everything and you could buy coins, but they didn't really do anything. This one is very much story-driven, freemium model. But on the flip side, you can get everything for free if you just play
work
the game.
Work your way through it. Work your way through. Seems to be a big model now. Warframe does it.
Yep. So for this one, for Plants vs. Zombies 2, an example, to go to the second world, I don't want to try. I'm going to try and give away not too much, but you have to get 15 stars, and you can either buy that for $4.99, or if you complete all of the courses on that level and then go through and do stars, you can get 15 stars, you can unlock it, and you can move on for free. And it's not like it's that hard to get 15
cool.
stars.
Yeah. So, good. All right. Well, mine was, I had a real trouble thinking of one, but then I remembered at the Unlab, where we tape, we had our games developers night last Thursday, and a gentleman, I didn't know this was happening, or else I would have certainly let you guys know. We've talked about the Oculus Rift before. Someone actually brought one in. It's a VR gaming headset. Had a chance to try it. Now, apparently you can take the one set of lenses off, so it will work for people with glasses. I didn't want to do that, so I just tried it, you know, and it was pretty impressive. They had a roller coaster demo, and then we played some Team Fortress 2, and I have to admit, I would love to try it with a flight sim. And some of the newer flight sims are directly supporting it now, including some of the freemium models. Very cool device.
I wonder if Warframe will support it.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It seems really interesting. I'd love to try
yeah,
one.
I was very impressed. The immersive experience when you're got that on and the headphones, you have to be really careful because your body will start to
move.
Yeah. So there was most times we had people sitting, but we had one guy. We tried a couple of guys standing with the demo, and you can see them as they're. You can see what they're seeing on the screen, but you can see them, you know, trying to adjust as the roller coaster goes left or right. Very immersive. I was very impressed. I'd heard the good reviews in that, but it's something that if I had the money and, you know, I love my flight sims, it would definitely either be on my Christmas list or on my buy list. So definitely.
It'll be interesting to see if this one actually finally sort of cracks the VR market, because for a long time there have been attempts at VR for computers and video games and stuff like that, but they've never really caught on. So it'll be interesting to see if this one does.
Exactly. Okay, before we go, just a couple other announcements. We have Ladies Learning Code with the Photoshop one.
Yes.
I just noticed Kelly McGregor, we just retweeted it. It's a whole intro to Photoshop. Are you taking part in that one?
No, I am going to be at Fan Expo.
Be a fan. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're going to go to Fan Expo. Give us a report.
Definitely will
on
do.
All the cosplayers and all the amazing costumes. And
hopefully there'll be some good tech there too.
Yep.
I'm hoping.
Hopefully some Doctor Who stories.
Well, last year Microsoft had a whole Halo thing. I'm hoping there's some Xbox Ones there.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to check out. Yeah, because you and your good wife are both going to that.
Yep.
So
and
nice.
Games Day podcasts are also going to be there. They're going up at least
one
day.
Good for them.
Gamer Pops are going to be going up for one of the days too.
So good stuff. So as I said, for Ladies Learning Code, it's August 24th. $50. It comes to $66 with tax and everything. But excellent course. They've got an excellent instructor for us. You've helped at some of the previous ones.
Yep.
You know, it's a good thing as well.
I highly recommend it.
Exactly. Anything else coming up we should be aware of?
So the weekend that Project Play is actually going to be a really busy weekend because the Ladies Learning Code London has also announced that they're taking part in National Learned Program Day.
Awesome.
And so that one's going to be the basic HTML. So Saturday is going to be Ladies Learning Code. Saturday night there is a board games night related to Project Play. All of the money that gets raised from that goes to Project Play. And then Project Play is on the Sunday.
Cool. Okay. Adam, anything else from your end?
Nope.
You find out on Wednesday if you're a master's candidate?
I do.
And then you can move on to your PhD, right?
Nope.
Just checking. All right. Well, we wish you all the best. We'll listen for the screams of delight or screams of horror come Wednesday.
Right.
So how does that work? Do they just take you in and say, I got good news or I got bad news?
Pretty much. The 9 a.m. Wednesday, I have to give a talk. And I give my talk.
Oh, so it is like a PhD defense.
Absolutely it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
no.
And this will not be a surrender like your first one.
Right. No. 9 a.m. Wednesday morning, I give a talk. After the talk, I get pulled into a room, and they ask me questions for God knows how long.
Is anyone available to come to the talk? Like, you know, could Jameson and I come?
You can come to the talk. You can't come to the part where I defend it.
Okay, so shall we bring some cheerleaders and
I'm going to try and talk you out of it, but if you really want, you can reserve seats at the grad club while I'm in for my defense, because either way I'm drinking after.
He's drinking after. Yep. Yeah, we'll have a lineup of beer ready for you. Well, good luck to you on Wednesday.
Thank you
very much. I'm sure you're going to do very, very well. Because, you know, I want to perfect this battery technology. I want a 24-hour battery on like something really, really tiny.
Right.
For my phone.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, that's all. Nothing. Nothing major, right?
No, nothing
you'll have been done within a year.
Yeah, for sure.
Excellent.
For sure.
Excellent.
And then he'll make lots of money.
Yeah. No, I'd love to have that down.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I think that's about it for us this week.
It's actually
turned out to be a nice long show. Every time I think the shows are going to be short, we end up going an hour and a half.
I can't believe that I cut you off in that argument 35 minutes ago and said we have 7 stories left.
I know.
Let's burn through them.
I know, that's good, though. That's awesome. So, for the Canadian Tech Podcast, episode 42 for August 19th, 2013, my name is Stuart Clark.
I'm Jameson Roberts.
I'm Adam Forrestal.
Thank you, and be well.